Good afternoon. Good to see you all. If you want to go ahead and turn in your Bibles, we're going to look in the book of Acts, chapter 4, is where we're going to begin in just a moment. Acts, chapter 4, and we're going to spend a little time there, if you don't mind. Tonight, we're continuing of of what it means to be people of light versus darkness. The contrasting of terms between God's light and the world of sin and Satan, that being of darkness. And how out of that, I had a text I wanted you to see, but there it is. John chapter 3 is kind of centered our theme on this text. In John chapter 3, judgment. This is God's judgment. This is God's declaration that light, Jesus, has come into the world and people love darkness rather than the light. Why? Because their works were evil. And so Jesus, why do people hate Jesus? Why is it that you get such a bitter reaction sometimes to Christianity from those who stand outside of it? Well, it's because it has really nothing to do with Jesus himself. It really has nothing to do with us. It really has all to do with themselves and where they live. And so we know that when light comes into a room, it chases out darkness. It exposes it for what it is. Those who are committing evil acts often like to stand in the darkness because it gives them cover. Well, why do they want that? Well, it's because of the guilt they feel of their own evil action. And so he says, for everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his... But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. And so, if I've done something right, I have no problem telling the world that, right? When you do something, when you've accomplished something in your life, we don't have an issue with telling people about it. We're excited, we're happy. But when I make a mistake, we had something happen yesterday. I won't give any names to protect the innocent here, but we were in Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby has lots of little things all around the world. It's not necessarily the place for a young person to be. And we had ventured through the store, and on two occasions, things had gotten knocked off the shelf. Just spontaneously, they jumped off. It was nobody's fault. At least that's what I heard. It wasn't my fault. They just fell. Right? So there was a ghost moving through the store or something, I guess. But then, finally, the third time was a charm. Something fell off, and the bitter crack occurred. And then Daddy had to go and wait in line to pay for a broken object. Well, this young perpetrator here, this dastardly deed, of course, was embarrassed about it, Why? Well, because he felt bad. Now, he has a tender heart, and he wants to do what's right. And so it bothers him when he doesn't do what's right. Well, that's the way it feels, right? That's not a serious scale, but there are serious things about good and evil. And when we commit sinful acts, there's a natural reaction to that. That is a feeling of guilt. And so this is such an important thing for us to think about in regard to light and dark. Now, I'm contrasting a few different themes. There are a lot more we could get into. But tonight, I want to talk about Barnabas and Ananias and Sapphira in chapter 5. So let's go over to chapter 4, and this is where we'll begin. So, and I actually want to go back just a little bit earlier, just to get the context. Of course, the Acts is a record of the works of the early church, and it focuses on a lot of the activities of the apostles, and in particular, Paul in the second half of the book is really becomes the central figure. of the text. And so in chapter 2, we have, after the first gospel sermon is preached, verse 41 tells us that there are 41 tells us there are 3,000 individuals who are baptized into Jesus Christ. 41 tells us, so those who received his word were baptized, and there added that day about 3,000 souls. So the church is beginning, and so you have these 3,000 members together and beginning to work and worship together. What's interesting is what fascinates me sometimes is what's not exactly in the text, but what we can infer from the text. One of the things that we noted this morning was this all occurred on the day of Pentecost. Now, Pentecost is kind of the bookend of a 50-day period of from the Passover to the day of Pentecost. And during this period of time, these two major gatherings of Jewish people, the city of Jerusalem was inundated with Jewish people from all over the world. Now, according to the law of Moses, of course, males had to travel to Jerusalem at least every 3 years for the Passover. And many, and I don't remember if the Pentecost is included in that, but many would stay over. So this is a long period of time. Now, that means that they're traveling away from their homes for 50 days. And now, on top of that, so you have all people from all over the world of that day who are now Christians. And this really would have thrown their life kind of upside down. Because you can't just go back home and go back to the way you used to live. This is a radical change in your life. And so there were a lot of issues that the early church would have faced in this regard into caring for these people. Because many of those people, this text sure seems to imply that they did not go home. Now, they've already been there 50 days. Now, I've never planned a trip over about 2 weeks. 50 days, we're getting close to 2 months. That's a long trip. That's a lot of, either you're packing a lot of clothes or you're going to have to find a washing machine somewhere, right? If we're going somewhere. We're also going to have to pay for all that food or find some means of eating. We're going to also have to find somewhere to stay. Now, you may have your house and they'll come stay for a few nights, but then what happens? Go home. Now just imagine you had relatives check in and they decide, you know what, I just really like it here. And so I'm going to hang out for just a little bit longer. And that's kind of what happened here. So we've dealt with a few people coming to our house a couple weeks ago for Thanksgiving. We had about 35 people come to our house for Thanksgiving. 35 people in our home. We start to feel the walls bounce a little bit. 3,000 people, though, I can't even think about that. That's 1,000 times the number, almost, of what was in our home. And we only cared for them for a morning into the afternoon, or afternoon. I can't imagine for all this time. And so the early church has some issues to deal with, and we see that in the first seven chapters of the book of Acts kind of deal with some of the issues they face. Go to chapter. Those seven men appointed, why were they appointed? Well, because the Hellenistic, the Jewish women, the widows who had come to Jerusalem, who had formerly lived outside of Jerusalem, now are there, are getting missed in the daily distribution of food. And so to solve the issue, the apostles say, select seven men from among your number. Now, I know this is a long explanation, but it really feeds into chapter 4 and 5. And hopefully you'll see why in a minute. And so the church is having to kind of strategically deal with this. Now, how long of a men's meeting would this take? Right? We want our men's meeting to begin at 9 and to go. You start getting close to 10 and you start getting some edginess, right? This is an hour, right? well, they're going to have to deal with these things. And they find some creative ways to do it. If you go back to chapter 2 and just go down the text, just a little, I want you to notice what they're doing. Verse 42 tells us that they're continuing to be together, just emphasizing this point. They're worshiping together. Verse 43 says that the apostles are continuing their work. They're performing miracles, but more importantly, they're continuing to teach. Verse 44 reminds us again, all who believed were together, and then adds this tagline, and had all things what? In common. Well, what does he mean by that? Well, he goes on to explain it, doesn't he? And they were selling their possessions and belongings, distributing the proceeds to all as any. So one of the ways they took care of the housing and food issue was they were selling their property. They were having a general collection, and then they were distributing food or whatever they were doing, and they were distributing it amongst one another. Now, as I mentioned, you get to chapter 6, as any time you get a group of people together, issues start arising. And so it's aim that you get to chapter 4, the end of chapter 4. So let's venture forward here to chapter 4. So remember, all this is still going on. Verse 32 tells us now, chapter 4, verse 32. Now the full number of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and no one said that any of the things that belonged to him was his own, but they what? Had everything in common. And that's almost verbatim, or it's definitely reflective of what you find in chapter 2. So that same atmosphere is continuing forward. Verse 33, and with great power, the apostles were giving their testimony to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. Again, that's almost, you almost have a rewrite of chapter 2, in chapter 2. And great grace was upon them all. Now, verse 34. And there was not a needy person among them, for as many as were owners of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold. Now, I want to mention first, well, let me come back to it. I'll mention this in a second. Verse 35. And laid it at the apostles' feet and distributed it to each as any had need. Thus Joseph, who was also called by the apostles Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, a Levite, a native of Cyprus, sold a field that belonged to him and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, I want you to note right away, this is our introduction to a man we will come more commonly known as Barnabas. Now, his actual name was Joseph. It wasn't Barnabas. That was just a nickname. And it's interesting that the nickname came from where? Well, from the apostles themselves. They called him Barnabas, which was a nickname that denoted his character, that he was the son of encouragement. I also want you to know, Barnabas is not the only guy doing this. I cannot know, and so I cannot tell you why Luke in particular chose to point out Barnabas. Now, I can maybe venture a guess that maybe it has something to do with what he'll do later on with Saul. And so he wants to introduce us kind of to him here. I don't know if that's the case or not, but maybe that's why he brings up Barnabas in particular. I think that's one reason. That's my opinion. The other thing, too, I think he is contrasting Barnabas with what we read in chapter 5 immediately after this. And so we're going to contrast those two as well. But you notice what Barnabas is doing. He's a man of some means. He had some wealth. And out of the great generosity of his heart, he's selling his own property. He's collecting those funds, and he's bringing it to the apostles, and then this distribution is continuing to go on. And so he seems to be one of the leaders in this effort. You also notice he's a Levite, so he was He was a Jew of some note. And so he also notes that he's a man of Cyprus. And that'll come up later on in the study of Book of Acts. So there's Barnabas. What would you say about him? Very benevolent, giving man. Now that's contrasted with chapter 5, those first 11 verses. Now that's a little lengthy reading, but I want to read it real quickly, if you'll continue with me. So I want you to have that image of Barnabas in your mind, and then contrast it with the image of Ananias and Sapphira. Or sold a piece of land. All right, so right away, they're just doing what they're seeing other people do. They're selling property just like everybody else. And what are they doing? They're giving it to the needs of others. Verse 2, and with his wife's knowledge, so he didn't just do this and get her into trouble because she was his wife. She took part in this. He kept back for himself some of the proceeds and brought only a part of it and laid it at the apostles' feet. So, similar to Barnabas, with one small contrast, isn't it? He didn't give all, he gave some. And that's, we're going to talk about that in just a minute, why that's important. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit, to keep back for yourself part of the proceeds? Now you read that first question, and you might think, well, was there an expectation of early Christians that they had to sell everything they had? Now that's what Jesus told the rich young ruler. He said, sell all that you have, give it to the poor, and then come follow me. Is that the mandate here? Well, keep reading. While it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? And after it was sold, was it not at your disposal? Why is it that you have contrived this deed in your heart? You have not lied to man, but to God. When Ananias heard these words, he fell down and breathed his last. And great fear came upon all who heard it. The young men rose and ran. After an interval of about 3 hours, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. And Peter said to her, tell me whether you sold the land for so much. And she said, yes, for so much. But Peter said to her, how is it that you've agreed together to test the Spirit of the Lord? Behold, the feet of those or and they will carry you out. And immediately she fell down at his feet and breathed her last. When the young men came in, they found her dead, and they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear came upon the whole church and upon all who heard these things. So, what's going on here? What fire? Was it that they commanded somehow that they had to sell everything, had to give it all to the church? Well, if you read the text, what you find out, that's not the case. Now, what happened with the rich young ruler? Individual situation with him. There are others. There were other wealthy members of the church and of the disciples of Christ before his death, burial, and resurrection who were not given the same command. And also, when you look at Peter's questioning, what does he put it on? Well, notice again, verse 4, while it remained unsold, did it not remain your own? After it was sold, was it not at your disposal to do with as you pleased? The sin here has nothing really to do with how much they gave, necessarily. It wasn't that they were commanded to give everything. It was that they lied and they conceived a lie about their giving. And I think it's interesting. What Peter says is that you didn't lie to just men, but actually your lie went beyond that. It's a lie against the Holy Spirit. And so really at the heart of their sin is this idea of greed. They wanted their cake and they wanted to eat it too. They wanted to be seen like Barnabas. And I wonder if part of what contrasting these two illustrations, these three individuals, is not to point out to us that what they really sought was not the good of their brethren. Were they not doing something that was good? They still gave to needy people. Yet, you look at the reaction of God, and God is not happy. Would it be kind of akin to the Ephesian church when Jesus says, you've left your first love? Their motive for what they were doing had become all wrong. And so, really, what they sin, it was a sin of greed, of being greedy. And so you have these contrasting ideas of benevolence versus greed. And this really, I think, hammers home at the conflict of many human beings, many men and women who are stuck between two worlds. You think about the rich young man. What was it that was his Achilles heel? He loved his stuff. His sin, like thee, greed. He had a greater desire to fulfill a fleshly need than he did to fulfill a spiritual need. And that's really what greed is about. It cost them their souls. 1 Peter chapter 6, verses 9 and following, Paul says, but those who desire to be rich, what? Fall into temptation, error, into many senseless and harmful ruin and destruction. You notice what he's saying there. Those who desire to be rich. Now, there have been individuals who serve God faithfully, also been wealthy. Think about David, a man after God's heart. God had blessed immensely. Think about Abraham. Abraham was a very wealthy man. Many others as well. You think about Joseph in the book of Genesis, a man second world power of the day, a man who could probably have anything he wanted. The thing he desired was what? Was God. All out. You think about Daniel was a man who'd risen to great power in the Babylonian kingdom, even though he was a Jew. Yet what was his desire? Well, his desire was. And so it's really about that desire of money. It's when it's become our passion in life, root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have. Now, I don't know a readership that Tolkien has in here, but if you've ever you remember, watch me forget it. Weird looking dude who is obsessed with the ring, right? He had become so enamored, so obsessed with possessing it that he destroyed it. In some ways, that's the way we look when we desire to be wealthy, when we desire the things of earth. The Laodiceans, I'm not going to read this whole passage. Y'all probably remember most of it, but in Revelation chapter 3, what was the sin of the Laodiceans? What's the awful sin? It doesn't talk about sexual morality. It doesn't necessarily, although probably their sin is their idol, their worship of own goodness, their own wealth, but greed. They had become in love with what they thought they could produce. And so to them that they had become wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, naked. Think about our own lives. Do I have to be greedy? Do I have to be rich to be greedy? nothing to do with what we possess. It has to do with our desire for it. God has to be in the parable of the rich fool in Luke chapter 12, Jesus depicts this man, this rich man, who had land that had produced plenty and had produced overwhelmingly so that even his own barns could not store it all up. What was his answer to that? Well, he'd been blessed by God, but mind he had earned this blessing on his own. And so what he said is to tear down the barns that he had into bigger barns and to store what was in excess in them. What God's blessed me immensely. Let me share with what I've got. I've got more than I need. Let me give to someone else. And of course, that parable ends in a troubling way. And fool, this night your soul will be prepared. Whose will they be? And so is the one who lays up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God. We have to be careful with greed. What we should strive for is benevolence and being a benevolent person. Again, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, you notice again Paul contrasting the love of money, greed, with that of contentment, of godliness. He says, but godliness with contentment, 1 Peter 6 and verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, these things we should be content. Have I found contentment in my life? And I'll end with this final text in Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12, you have Jesus sitting in the temple, and he's watching the money box, and he's watching people's reaction to it. And as he sits there, he's watching, and these very wealthy individuals are coming, and they're dropping large sums of money into the box. Now, from a human perspective, we'd look at that, and we'd say, wow, look how benevolent they are. Like, you think about men, not trying to pick on anybody, but this is just to illustrate. People who are very wealthy, who've earned millions and if not billions of dollars, give large sums of money around the world to causes they support. And people will say, well, look how generous they are. Look at how good they are. And I ask the question, have we missed the point? Now, I'm glad that they want to be giving. I'm glad they have some generosity. But are they given to the point that they're ever in danger of not being wealthy? Now, you go back to Mark chapter 12, and you contrast those givers with this one woman who gave two mites, two very small measures of money. And you notice what Jesus said in verse 43. He says, say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box. For they have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had. All she had to live on. You know, the tagline he adds on there, I think it's pretty significant. Woman doesn't have an ounce of greed. Everything to God. Why is she able to do that? Well, she does it because we've been studying Elijah and Elisha recently, and the one woman who gave who made these cakes for Elijah out of the very last bit of flour she had. Her and her sons had nothing else to live on. That was it. And yet she did it anyway. Well, Contrast that attitude with the attitude of many that we know in our lives. You think about some of the ways we can show benevolence to others, and I'll quickly read these, and it'll be yours. But how is it in our life that you and I can show benevolence to those around us? We think, number one, of our money. What kind of person am I in regard to the blessings that God had given to me in my bank account? I want to reverse the question there and ask, what kind of hold does your money have on you? I don't think it's necessarily as important to think about what money we hold, what is it that has a hold on us? Does our money, or are we benevolent in our giving, and our giving to others? What about our time? What kind of time do we put into serving God and to serving those around us? What about our effort, our energy? I'll give as long as it doesn't cost me any time or effort, right? I'll give as long as it's easy for me. Well, is that the attitude we should have? And then finally, our attitude that we present to others. The amount of good that can be done just simply by our attitude and helping others to see Christ living in us. You think about your relationship with Jesus this evening, and you consider where you are in your walk with Him. Now, what has a hold of you? What really holds your attention and your affection? And the truth is, if it's anything but God, then we're in trouble, isn't it? God has to be number one in our lives. This evening, if He's not, let me encourage all of us to consider our walk, to consider the need for forgiveness that maybe exists in our lives, for the need for us to continue to challenge ourselves in our attitude, in considering what is it in our lives that really has a hold on us. If you have a need to respond this evening, we want to invite you, encourage you to please respond to God's call as we sing.